Support for STAT, the podcast of Internal Medicine News, comes from Merck for Univatus Medical News Service. Welcome to STAT, the podcast of Internal Medicine News, with the latest advancements in medicine and clinical practice. In this half hour, reports on Herceptin.
In two large phase 3 trials, the antibody cut recurrences in breast cancer by 52%.
The one question screen for alcohol abuse.
In medicine, it's been said, get a good history and you've got the diagnosis.
Using light rays to measure atherosclerosis.
There's a new select non-invasive test that doesn't require a blood draw, pretest fasting, or a skin biopsy to measure skin cholesterol.
A Danish study that says antidepressants don't get credit for a drop in suicides. And a traditional plant remedy from China, kudzu. It's good for something at last. I'm Marty Goldenson with STAT, the podcast of Internal Medicine News. As you listen to this podcast in your office, on the beach, or on the road, remember that you can get complete stories in Internal Medicine News at einternalmedicinenews.com and find these STAT medical podcasts online. This week's lead story. It's not often that drug findings are greeted with rock star-style applause at the annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology in Orlando, Florida. But that's just what happened this year, when the results of drug trials for trastuzumab, marketed as Herceptin, were presented. Dr. George Sledge from the Indiana University Cancer Center in Indianapolis described the findings as the most stunning results he'd seen in an adjuvant trial in his entire career. And he believes that we can finally start to see the outlines of the Breast Cancer End campaign. Dr. Garnet Butler has the details.
It's possible that the most effective treatments we will have for cancer will be immune system related, like this monoclonal antibody Herceptin. In two large phase 3 trials, the antibody cut recurrences in breast cancer by 52%. And in a third international trial that included 5,100 women in 39 countries, the risk of recurrence fell 46% when trastuzumab was used once every 3 weeks for 12 months after completion of chemotherapy for primary breast cancer. Dr. Ramon, who was at the University of Kentucky Markey Cancer Center in Lexington, reported that the addition of trastuzumab conferred a 33% reduction in the overall risk of death and a 53% reduction of risk of distant recurrence at 3 years. In about 30% of breast cancer patients, the gene HER2 stimulates fast cancer growth by overproducing the HER2 protein. Patients with tumors positive for HER2 have poor prognoses and often relapse soon after completing a first round of cancer therapy. Trastuzumab works by inhibiting the HER2 receptor. The antibody is marketed internationally by Roche and in the United States by Genentech.
Thanks, Dr. Butler. Our story came from reporting by Jane Saladoff-McNeil. You can find the whole article in the June 15, 2005 issue of Internal Medicine News at www.einternalmedicinenews.com. Next up, light and a vitamin also show promise for cancer.
With these latest results about vitamin D, perhaps a little fun in the summer sun is not so bad after all.
I've always been amazed at how sunlight shining on skin produces vitamin D, a nutrient necessary for life. Now, Dr. Wei Zhao from Harvard School of Public Health has found that survival rates are increased in patients who had surgery during the summer when they had higher vitamin D intakes. Dr. Robert Schreiber explains.
It's remarkable, Marty, that photons emanating from the sun hit our skin, which start the process of converting skin cholesterol to vitamin D. In reality, so-called vitamin D is more like a hormone than most other vitamins, which might explain why recent research on vitamin D is highlighting its importance in not just bone physiology, but also so many other physiologic processes. Dr. Zhao's work is another example of this. His research involved 456 patients who underwent surgery between 1992 and 2000 for stage 1 or 2 non-small cell lung cancer. The researchers studied outcomes based on vitamin D intake from food and supplements, using a diet questionnaire, and based on the season the surgery was performed. Those who had surgery in the summer and were also in the top quartile of vitamin D intake had a threefold better disease-free survival rate and a fourfold better overall survival rate than did patients who had their surgery in the winter and were in the lowest quartile of vitamin D intake. In terms of overall survival, patients who had surgery in the winter were 25% more likely to die within 5 years than those who were operated on in the summer. Dr. Zhao reported these findings at the recent annual meeting of the American Association of Cancer Research in Anaheim, California. His results lend support to epidemiologic studies done over the last 30 years, suggesting that cancer incidence and mortality may vary with the level of ultraviolet B radiation in the patient's environment.
So, does this mean that surgeries should be timed for the summer?
Probably not, Marty. Dr. Zhao emphasized that his study in no way suggests that people should try to time their cancer surgeries for a particular season. But if the results are validated, it may mean that increasing a patient's use of vitamin D before surgery could offer a survival benefit.
Thanks, Dr. Schreiber, for that report from an article by Robert Finn. We'll be hearing more about vitamin D on future STAT podcasts of Internal Medicine News. STAT audio podcasts are designed exclusively to serve the medical profession. We welcome your comments. Write stat@medicalnewspodcasts.com. Up next, NewsStat, our roundup of timely developments with Dr. William Campbell Douglas. Hi, Dr. Douglas. What's making medical news this week?
Marty, Dr. Butler reported on Herceptin, but there's another antibody making medical news for the treatment of cancer. It's the anti-angiogenic monoclonal antibody bevacizumab, which blocks vascular endothelial growth factor. When the antibody was added to standard chemotherapies for patients with lung, breast, and colorectal cancer, it produced significant survival gains, reported at the annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. The results were hailed as an advance likely to change the standard of care for these leading forms of cancer. And a minor tremor from the West Coast. In California, nearly 6,000 patients were potentially exposed to blood-borne pathogens from improperly disinfected colonoscopes, gastroscopes, endoscopes, and cystoscopes over a 2-year period. A report from Betsy Bates says the problem is by no means confined to one or two states. It's a global problem wherever endoscopy is done. The actual risk of infection from an improperly disinfected endoscope is probably small, perhaps 1 in 10,000 patients, but it still deserves attention. Often, cleaning devices don't fit endoscopes properly, or cleaning instructions are misunderstood. 4 hospitals found auxiliary water channels on colonoscopes which were never cleaned or disinfected. One hospital discovered this after 18 months when fecal material leaked from the channel prior to use.
There's more interesting news from California, but perhaps less unsettling. We've all heard the concern that pharmaceutical industry funding may influence medical research findings. Will fruit farmers now enter the fray? Looks like California fruit farmers have underwritten research into the health benefits of their produce. University of California, Los Angeles researchers have a grant from the California Strawberry Commission to develop a standardized strawberry extract for use in both in vitro and in vivo research. Investigators will use the extract to evaluate whether strawberries have anti-cancer and antioxidant properties. Right about here, I wish I could cue in the Beatles song Strawberry Fields Forever. You can see the clout I have around here. Oh well. Those briefs from NewsStat, our weekly news roundup, with thanks to Dr. Campbell Douglas. Dr. Douglas will be back with some news from the world outside of medicine. And still ahead, what I've always suspected, a little exercise can be a dangerous thing. But first, even I have heard about the possible link between bacteria and ulcers. But I never knew a bacteria which causes ulcers in the stomach could also contribute to atherosclerosis. Dr. Joy Ravan joins us now to explain. So, Dr. Ravan, just how is the stomach bone connected to the heart bone when it comes to cardiovascular disease?
Marty, it has to do with a pesky, stubborn bug in the gut called Helicobacter pylori. Apparently, the inflammation from these bacteria infecting the stomach contributes to a systemic vascular inflammation throughout the body. This results in vascular dysfunction at the inner lining of the arteries, what we call the endothelium.
Okay, my stomach gets infected with this pest, and it not only makes me susceptible to ulcers, but possibly wreaks havoc in my arteries, causing them to be inflamed?
That essentially appears to be it. There's substantial research supporting the link between cardiovascular disease, chronic infections, and the resultant inflammation from those infections.
This link between Helicobacter pylori and ulcers is intriguing enough, but now there's a connection with heart disease. What a discovery.
Yes, it is. Back in 1983, Australian doctors Robin Warren and Barry Marshall published their research pointing to the bug as the cause of stomach ulcers. Now, just studying this one bacterium has become practically a research industry in itself.
I understand that the research is by Dr. Tetsuya Oshima at Japan's University Graduate School of Biomedical Sciences in Hiroshima. What can you tell us about Dr. Oshima's study?
He looked at 81 healthy Japanese men with average age of 40 years who were non-smokers. He measured their serum levels of C-reactive protein and levels of soluble intercellular adhesion molecule. Both are markers for vascular inflammation and endothelial activation. He found the markers were much higher in men who were seropositive for H. pylori compared to the men who were seronegative for the bacterium. Importantly, Dr. Oshima also found that the men who were infected or seropositive with H. pylori also had reduced flow-mediated vasodilation.
So if my stomach's infected with this helico bug, my blood vessels might not dilate like they should?
That's what the findings suggest, Marty. But the impaired dilation is really a consequence of the inflammation. Dr. Oshima and his colleagues are hypothesizing that chronic infections with H. pylori directly or indirectly induce a persistent systemic vascular inflammation and endothelial dysfunction.
Inflammation in the stomach contributes to inflammation in the blood vessels, and the inflammation in the blood vessels contributes to heart disease. Sounds like the blame for cardiovascular disease has shifted from high fats in the blood to infection and inflammation.
That's correct, Marty. But fats and cholesterol still play a big part in heart disease. In fact, in an upcoming report, I'll tell you how testing cholesterol levels in the skin may help us detect atherosclerosis in people who have no symptoms of heart disease at all.
Thanks, Dr. Ravan. The Internal Medicine News report was written by Marianne Moon. Dr. Oshima's original research was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, Volume 45. STAT, the podcast of Internal Medicine News, brings you the latest medical and clinical headlines from Internal Medicine News. We know that regular exercise has all kinds of benefits, but a little bit of exercise can be dangerous. Data from a new study showed that the risk for women of exercise-triggered sudden cardiac death is actually higher in occasional exercisers than in women who are total couch potatoes. However, data from the same study demonstrates that in women who do regular exercise, the risk of sudden cardiac death is markedly diminished. Here's Dr. Robert Schreiber to explain.
Thanks, Marty. The Nurses' Health Study is the first large study to focus on exercise as a triggering event for sudden cardiac death in women. It's true that exercise transiently increases the risk of ventricular arrhythmia, but overall the evidence of health benefits from physical activity greatly outweighs the evidence for risk. Based on the findings from 70,000 women with a mean age of 57 years, Dr. William Wang of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston reported the marked decrease in risk of sudden death among women who exercise regularly. The data showed a remarkable decrease in the risk of exercise-associated sudden cardiac death when women engage in about 4 or more hours of moderate to vigorous physical activity per week. The 4-hour-per-week frequency appears to be an inflection point, with women who exercise less than 4 hours having higher overall long-term risk of sudden cardiac death. Dr. Wang presented his findings during the annual meeting of the Heart Rhythm Society. The investigators defined moderate to vigorous exercises involving activities such as brisk walking, jogging, swimming, tennis, and believe it or not, lawn mowing.
Thanks, Dr. Schreiber, for that report from an article by Bruce Jansen for Internal Medicine News. Lawn mowing? Maybe I'll tell my wife.
Beam me up, Marty. There's a new select non-invasive test that doesn't require a blood draw, pretest fasting, or a skin biopsy to measure skin cholesterol.
A new skin test that beams light on the palm of the hand accurately detects atherosclerosis in asymptomatic patients.
It does it by taking colorimetric readings after light is beamed onto the palm of your hand.
Sounds like something Dr. McCoy used on Star Trek. Dr. Joy Ravan reports.
Thanks, Marty. We know that carotid artery thickness, measured by B-mode ultrasound, is a well-validated marker for subclinical atherosclerosis. Using the new PrevU point-of-care skin sterol test, cardiologist James Stein at the University of Wisconsin compared skin tissue cholesterol with carotid artery thickness in 80 patients. All patients in the study had cardiovascular risk factors, but none had known vascular disease or symptoms. The correlation between skin cholesterol and carotid artery thickness was so high that it had a strong predictive value for detecting atherosclerosis. Dr. Stein reported his results at the recent annual meeting of the American College of Cardiology in Orlando, Florida. International Medical Innovations, the company that developed the PrevU test, funded the study.
Dr. Ravan, how does this light beam device fit with the array of other heart disease tests?
Because skin cholesterol is easy to measure with this non-invasive test, it may be useful as an office-based tool for cardiovascular risk prediction. Within 3 to 5 minutes, the office-based physician can have an answer regarding possible cardiovascular disease risk, and then hopefully guide the patient in the right direction therapeutically.
So can my doctor now essentially beam light on the palm of my hand to measure cholesterol instead of drawing blood?
Not really, Marty. It's not an alternative to measuring blood cholesterol or to the newer blood markers like C-reactive protein and homocysteine, since all the blood tests complement each other in an overall assessment. Dr. Stein described this skin cholesterol test as an anatomic measure of the atherosclerotic disease process itself, not just another blood marker associated with atherosclerosis.
Find more details about Dr. Stein's findings in Bruce Jansen's article in the June 15th issue of Internal Medicine News. I'm Marty Goldenson with STAT, the podcast of Internal Medicine News. Too many hours in medicine have you feeling a little burned out? In our regular feature, Practice Trends for the Rest of Your Life, writer Doug Brunk says, all work and no play? No way. The opinion is presented by internist William Campbell Douglas.
You and I were once starry-eyed, idealistic pre-med students, romantic and full of wonder about medicine. But if you're like me, it didn't take many years after internship and residency, confronting suffering and disability, pain, trauma, death, before my idealism gave way to disillusionment. Author Doug Brunk spotlights doctors who successfully fight disillusionment by doing regular, highly enjoyable activities outside our profession. Dr. Jerry Rogoff was in his workshop recently when his wife called him. Jerry, aren't you going to eat today? Surprised at how time had flown by, he asked her if it was time for lunch, and she said, no, it's supper time. He had become so engrossed in his woodworking that he lost all track of time. There's something very therapeutic about that. About 3 times a year, Dr. Francis Rushton goes on brief backpacking adventures. It's his way to be active but mindless. After 2 to 3 days of hiking, he has physically worked out the frustrations of his office. He describes it as a cleansing of the mind. And then he's ready to charge forth seeing patients again. Physically creative activities allow us to lose track of time. That's therapy. Hey, I'm feeling a little like a one-dimensional doc these days. I know I need more balance, or I'm no good to anybody. All work and no play? No way.
Opinion from Doug Brunk was presented by William Campbell Douglas. Dr. Douglas practices in Central Florida. We invite comments on issues in this podcast or in your practice. Email to stat@medicalnewspodcasts.com. That's stat with an exclamation point afterward at medicalnewspodcasts.com. Please include a daytime phone number and tell us how to pronounce your name. You're listening to STAT, the podcast of Internal Medicine News. It's been widely reported that the use of antidepressants has risen significantly in most Western countries over the last 20 years. At the same time, there's been an apparent decrease in suicide rates. But perhaps antidepressants shouldn't get the credit. Dr. Garnett Butler explains.
Thanks, Marty, and that's right. Dr. Annette Erlingsen of Pennsylvania State University conducted a 5-year study in Denmark that showed the vast bulk of the drop in the suicide rates involved the 96% of Danes who were not taking an antidepressant prescription. Dr. Erlingsen presented her results at the recent American Association of Suicidology conference in Broomfield, Colorado. The study, conducted from 1996 to 2000, included all of the nearly 2.5 million Danes aged 50 years or older and was based on data from the Danish National Health Registry. Only older Danes were considered because suicide rates are highest in seniors, who also use proportionately the largest amount of SSRIs. During the study, the suicide rate fell from 35 in 100,000 among the older men to 27 in 100,000. Similarly, the annual suicide rate among older women dropped from 14 to 11 per 100,000. A key finding was that 90% of the decline in the suicide rate among older men and 76% of the drop in women was accounted for by individuals not on antidepressants. In fact, the suicide rate in persons taking antidepressants was far higher than in those who were not taking such prescriptions.
So essentially, the results show that these SSRIs, or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, have not impacted the total suicide rate during the second part of life.
That's correct. And on a universal level, it appears the medications haven't worked as a suicide prevention strategy either.
Thanks, Dr. Butler. Now, we know that alcoholism is linked to depression and suicide, and many doctors are familiar with the CAGE questionnaire for identifying possible alcoholism in their patients. But there may be an even easier approach. Our next report shows how asking patients just one question can reveal alcohol abuse.
In medicine, it's been said, get a good history and you've got the diagnosis. There's some truth to this.
As many as 25% of patients in primary care settings could be engaging in hazardous drinking. Now, a doctor has come up with a new screening exam which involves asking just one crucial question. Dr. Campbell Douglas reports.
Of course, the physical exam and tests are essential, but most important are the questions we ask the patient. Unfortunately, when it comes to diagnosing alcohol abuse, we miss out on helping a lot of people for a number of reasons. First, we get in the habit of thinking the issue is not that important as part of the total history and plan. Second, it's hard to assess if the patient's response to our questions actually indicates alcohol abuse. And finally, we ask ourselves, what are we going to do about alcohol abuse if it's really there? Dr. Daniel Vincent of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of Missouri, Columbia, attempted to arrive at what might be called the one magic question physicians can ask to screen for alcohol abuse. Dr. Vincent's study compared interviews with over 2,500 patients with 1,000 community members serving as controls. According to Dr. Vincent, identification of the alcohol abuse can lead to successful treatment and intervention in up to 40% of alcohol abuse patients.
So, what is the magic question, doctor, to screen patients for alcohol abuse?
For men, it's this. When was the last time you had more than 5 drinks in one day? If the patient offers a date within the past 3 months when he's consumed 5 drinks in that one day, there's a very strong likelihood that patient abuses alcohol. When asking female patients, substitute 5 drinks with 4.
Okay, so when was the last time you had 5 drinks in one day, doctor?
Marty, it was years ago during a party at college, and the resultant headache told me, never again.
Of course, millions of people aren't so fortunate to have those bodily signals which say, that's enough. But now, doctors have this simple diagnostic tool. The study was funded by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Details can be found in the June 15, 2005 issue of Internal Medicine News. You're listening to STAT, the podcast of Internal Medicine News. And now, hang on to your stethoscopes, it's rapid fire. Our quick list of developments you'll find at einternalmedicinenews.com. Here again, Dr. Joy Ravan.
Thanks, Marty. Here's a list of current topics. Risagiline controls early Parkinson's symptoms. Peripheral neuropathy is seen with use of leflunomide. Tamoxifen for breast cancer is tied to lower heart disease risk. Chronically ill patients skip medication at least once per month due to high costs. At 5 years, uterine artery embolization for fibroids is effective in 73% of patients. And you'll like this one, Marty. Computer keyboard bacteria travel to healthcare workers' hands.
Remember that you can get complete stories in Internal Medicine News at einternalmedicinenews.com. Last but not least, the Chinese and the Japanese had their reasons for cultivating the ubiquitous and troublesome vine we call kudzu. Reviled for its ability to kill trees by choking out the sun, and revered for its ability to camouflage unsightly abandoned rusting car frames, the yellowish-green kudzu vine covers over 7 million acres of the American South. But kudzu is proving to be good for something at last. You might be telling your child who's heading off to college, "Sally, here's 3 months' worth of kudzu to last till you're home for the holidays." Researcher Scott Lucas, Ph.D. at McLean Hospital, Belmont, Massachusetts, looked at the effect of kudzu on 14 men and women in their 20s who reported imbibing 3 to 4 alcoholic drinks per day. The subjects who took a daily capsule of kudzu extract for 1 week consumed almost 50% less alcohol than similar drinkers taking a placebo. Dr. Lucas said the people taking the kudzu were more responsive to signals that the alcohol was giving their bodies and realized they didn't need to drink as much. Could kudzu catch the attention of beer-swilling college students as a way to stretch their drinking dollar? More money for pinball? But really, how likely is it that these party people are going to keep up with the alcoholism literature? Dr. Lucas' findings were reported in the May 2005 issue of Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research. Our report from Internal Medicine News was written by Sally Koch-Kubitin. All the items in this STAT podcast can be found in print at einternalmedicinenews.com and our audio archive at www.medicalnewspodcasts.com. Content and opinion in this podcast are edited independently by International Medical News Group, Flow Productions, and Murray Street, who are solely responsible for its content. Our producers are Lauren Krenzel, Dr. Campbell Douglas, and Steve Rath, with technical production by Chris Hurless, information technology Calvin Simmons. If you set your iPodder for the STAT podcast from Internal Medicine News, we'll be back with you in 2 weeks with more on medicine from the 21st century. I'm Marty Goldenson. Support for IMNG's STAT medical podcasts comes from Merck for Univadis Medical News Service, discovering medicines to make a difference, and medical resources to keep you informed. Merck is proud to support leadership in medical communications.